90% believe science is not objective. So I teach a course trying to persuade them, no, no, but objective hai waise. You know, so I do all that, but you know, that's not what I am suggesting. But I am saying that asking the right kind of question is very important. And there are questions framed in appropriate ways that help you answer certain social or economic issues that are on the agenda. And in climate change, this is something you have to be aware of, I would say, all the time. And I will illustrate this with a, this talk is an illustration based on a particular example. And there could, there are many more such examples that one could work on or think about. So this is basically work done with my colleagues Tejal Kanitkar and Mario D'Souza at the Tata Institute of Social Sciences. Mario is no longer there. And two friends who are very sharp about science and have worked a lot on policy issues, even though they are not necessarily academics, Prabir Purkayastha and D. Raghunandan. So this work with Prabir and Raghu, we began the work, but we have carried it forward at TISS considerably since then. So we have a number of papers sort of directly and indirectly related to the subject of what I'm going to speak today. And there are some specific references and others which generally provide background to the area if you're further interested. So just to remind you of the setting, I will not spend too much time on this. Global warming is something which is underway. This is very sort of, you know, if it should be part of general knowledge now, so to speak, that it is not a threshold phenomenon which will happen sometime in the future. Various kind of consequences of climate change can be threshold phenomena, because if temperature or rainfall or various other consequences of warming give rise to certain weather or climate effects, then the way they start to impact may happen only when they cross some threshold value of some variable. But per se, climate change itself is not a threshold phenomenon. Temperatures have risen, polar ice caps are melting. You know, one needs to keep one's head about the data. Data goes back and forth. You know, every year, you know, fluctuations are there. So, but you know, and even scientists from various institutions occasionally fall into the temptation of getting a bit of headlines. So, you know, you can write the paper in a proper fashion, but when the press release comes out from your university, just give it a little bit of a tweak. So, you know, or the other thing I think which confuses the lay public in this issue is that scientists always, you know, when people do science, you know, you always try to find, sometimes, you know, you are fascinated by a oddball solution, you know, something in general nobody quite believes is what is happening or what will happen, but you have a kind of, you know, what if this happens. And those who have followed particle physics will remember this stuff about black holes being produced at the LHC, which will swallow the Earth, etc. And you know, the CERN PR guys had a hard time convincing the public they were not going to blow up the place. Unfortunately, we can't do as well in India as our friends in INO are well aware. So anyway. So I think, so sometimes, you know, there are this what if scenarios given all the uncertainties and modeling, etc. And sometimes people run away with what if scenarios, and that causes some confusion in the lay public. But otherwise, I think these are all stuff which you know very well. Just one small point because of what Alex said. I think one of the real challenges that remains in climate modeling, I am not an expert in climate modeling, but this has serious policy and other implications. Modeling precipitation is very poor. Basically, precipitation is modeled in as convective cells. So basically, the heating below creates water vapor and it rains right there. So on that grid, okay. So when there is long distance transport, okay, then modeling is not in good shape. Friends at the IITM, Tropical Meteorology Institute in Pune, believe they have some better models on this which they are going to try. But the jury is out on it, and in particular monsoon predictions from climate modeling are poor, even on the All India scale, and if you go to regional scale, they are positively unusable. Has climate change effects? This is well known. Climate change does have effects. So, you know, various flora and fauna are moving northwards, you know, moving to higher latitudes from lower latitudes. This phenomenon is seen in many places. It has amusing consequences, like, you know, diseases from Africa moving into southern Italy. It's not amusing, but amusing in the sense they have this whole, you know, undercurrent of, you know, disdain towards Africa. They have a complex history with Africa and Italy. So when chikungunya appears in southern Italy, that's something of an issue. Dengue, for instance, is a new threat in Texas and Florida for the same reasons that they are a threat here, that there is collection of fresh water, and I have seen pictures of, you know, car dumps, etc., you know, where used cars are dumped, old tires are dumped, and they collect water and breeds dengue. So, you know, so all these kinds of things are happening in the Altopiano, the Andes, very high. There was no malaria. The first four cases, Anopheles was found there a few years ago. First four cases of malaria were reported 2 or 3 years ago. So these are issues. There is an impact on agriculture, but it's not as if absolute fall in yields or even any kind of absolute reduction in production is taking place in agriculture. I don't have time to discuss this, but basically it has a depressor effect. But in countries like India, the gap between our potential agricultural production and, you know, is so great from the actual production that the effect of climate is not the real driver controlling production. So production grows, yields grow, because there's still room to do so. But in, even in India, you can see flora and fauna effects. Apple has moved to higher districts in Himachal Pradesh. There's a distinct trend, and there is strong evidence that this is climate change. So tank bred carps in West Bengal, the breeding season has lengthened. Breeding begins earlier in the season. It's not like May, it has moved forward by a month and a half, which is quite useful because it improves, you know, production, and they get in a season where prices are high. But then, you know, it may not last because the summer temperature then, you know, will reach a point where it will become too much. So again, you know, the breeding season will shorten, but from the other end, that's a possibility. So you know, so the really the problem is the future. So I think climate change is here. Climate change has impacts. There's no need for some of the panicky talk, you know. Nobody is exempt from this, really. And it was a bit disgusting. In the UNFCCC, I was there at Paris, tagged along with some NGO, and they paid my bills, etc. So you walk into the main negotiating area, there is this enormous television screen playing scenes from the Chennai floods, which were happening at the same time. And so there is this somewhat tear-choked voice of a young man saying, "Oh, climate change is here. You must take climate change seriously all over the world." Now the jury is out, you know, totally. Whether, you know, the problem in Chennai was mishandling of the water management, that is more or less the immediate cause. The whether it is an extreme event. It certainly is an extreme event, unprecedented over a very long period, perhaps more than 100 years. But attribution of individual events to climate change is a delicate game, and that of course is lost in the din of all the conversation on climate change. And the entire UN negotiations are not about pushing an event like this in order to keep the ball rolling in negotiations. So this happens all the time. So anyway, but nevertheless, climate change is here. We should take it seriously. And the burden of my talk is, despite all this hoopla, despite such videos, despite such a rhetoric, the Paris Agreement did not really take climate change as seriously as it should. And for reasons which are transparent and easy to understand, it is obvious even to lay people if you just sit down and explain it briefly. But the reason it does not happen is precisely because of the way politics works on this. So what should we do to keep the world safe? So I should go on for, say, 45 minutes, 50 minutes? How much? Perfect. So what should we do to keep the world safe? To keep the world safe, of course, you know, there are various ways you have to deal with the inevitable impacts of global warming and so on and so forth. But the basic thing you have to do is to keep the rise in temperature within limits. What exactly, precisely is the limit? And would we be able to quantify it with any sense of precision? The answer is no, because the consequences of climate change are manifold. They occur in all kinds of sectors. In parts of the world, they may have a positive effect. For instance, the Russians are the only ones known to start occasionally climate change talks with the first slide being the benefits of climate change. Nobody else quite does that. And they do that because, you know, various things, you know, they have a typically problem with their wheat growing season, etc., etc. So, you know, climate change may bring them benefits. Agriculture production in certain parts of the world for certain crops may positively improve. Okay. I hope they won't end up growing rice in New York, but that would be disaster for us, you know, but you know, shifts are possible. So it's very hard to actually quantify. But I think there is a large consensus which has evolved, especially among the scientists, that somewhere around 2 degrees centigrade is the cutoff. You know, beyond 2, you are really in unknown territory. Between 1.5 and 2, you know, if it were only 1, we'd be happy. But there is no chance we are going to stay at 1 day. By 1 degree centigrade, you know, when you say global warming is 1 degree, temperature rise should be 1 degree centigrade, we are talking of the global average surface temperature, annual average. So, you know, that's a really complicated exercise. You have to area weight it, etc. And there are people who specialize in doing that kind of thing. And the rise is with respect to 1750. Or they specify, if you see the IPCC in the fifth assessment report of 2013, they specify that it is the rise over 1860, 1881 or something like that. So roughly 1850 is the benchmark figure. Okay.
Where are we now?
We are at, as I showed on the last slide, 0.85 to 1 with respect to 1850, 1870. This is taking the average. Yeah.
Respect to the interval.
Yeah. Both of them are equally problematic, and one of the.
All we hear is only this rise part, not about the.
Oh, no. I think, in fact, if you go to a different crowd, you will hear only about the variability part. This whole idea about the Chennai floods being called climate change, attributed to climate change, is actually mistaking variability for the change. Yeah, so I think these confusions exist, but there are issues here, perhaps we can discuss it later. So, So roughly the figure is 1.5 or 2 degrees, but this is a global problem, and you see there is a question of how do we share this burden. So you cannot say the world should do it. The world is composed of, we do not have a world government for now, thank God, but you know. So given that the world is composed of nations, the guiding principle is basically the UNFCCC. The UNFCCC is a remarkable document formulated in 1992 at the Rio Earth Summit. If we had to meet to draft that UNFCCC today, it would be impossible. So all our ideas on sustainable development, it's a remarkable three documents which were prepared at that conference. It was a high tide of ethical optimism, I would say, on the global scale, and it reached a peak. After that, it has been steadily downhill. But the two major points that I think that are central to our part of the story is the fact that the world has to be protected. And there is a choice of words in this which has a little bit of an issue, because that clearly borrows from the scientific understanding most current at that time. The understanding has slightly shifted, but not that this is incorrect, but there are better ways perhaps to state the problem. And that of course is not quite here, but the burden of the story is you have to protect the world, and that's a responsibility. And how should the burden be shared? So everybody is responsible, as the first part of the sentence of Article 3.1 states. It is the parties, refers to the parties to the convention, all countries. Parties should protect the climate system for the benefit of present and future generations of humankind, not their own citizens. So it really is a clear call to considerations of global equity. It is not simply that you are suffering, but there is the fact that you must act to prevent harm to humanity as a whole. Implementing this is the devil's own business, and that's whole problem of the negotiations. But the principle is obvious. On the basis of equity and in accordance with their common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. In the jargon of the climate trade, it's called CBDR. So, you know, common but differentiated responsibility. If you are really finicky, you write and RC. So the whole story of the Paris Agreement in some sense is the slide from a positive, proactive understanding of that second part of Article 3.1 and its considerable dilution to the point there are people who argue that perhaps the convention, the UNFCCC, has been irrevocably diluted. So that's the crux of the story. So how does that work out? So the question is, of course, sharing the burden. As it says earlier, everybody must do their share, but based on common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities. So the problem is not simply global warming, what to do about global warming, but the problem is what to do about global warming in an unequal world. That's the crux of the problem. If it were an equitable world, then solving the problem would look entirely different. And it is what it is because of this. So what are the problems? Developing countries. There is this whole issue of international equity in trade, in patents, in this and that, in the way conflicts are handled, in the way monetary systems work, all of it. But specifically with regard to climate and related issues, there are large energy needs. The cheapest source of energy continues to be fossil fuels. You can't get rid of fossil fuels overnight. There are people who have this, you know, let's go zero carbon. You know, it's like saying you can switch off the lights. That's not possible, seriously. Large populations with serious energy deficits, we are a global leader in this respect. unsurprisingly. And given the uncertainties of both the economics, technology and the international trade and economic environment, planning for future infrastructure and estimating how much emissions you will need in order to be able to do that is really tricky business. It's full of uncertainties. Economists have the bad habit, unlike climate modelers, of not taking their predictions of say 20 years ago and checking whether how many of them worked out. No? So, Paul Krugman writes this column in NYT, New York Times. It would be interesting to take all his columns for 25 years and check it against the facts. but even in modeling, they have made drastic predictions which have never come true, nuclear power being a classic case. So, that is on one side. On the other side, so this uncertainty of the future, you know, dealing with this uncertainty, what people call deep uncertainty, and it is not even simply a question of unknowns. There is a whole range of unknown unknowns that you have to deal with when you are talking about climate change mitigation and adaptation. Anyway, so the other point is developed countries who have been reluctant to take the lead. So, Trump's. As Gautam pointed out to me, Trump in the title, if Trump comes, God knows what's going to happen to climate change, is really up in the air. Obama promised Prime Minister Modi that they will urge ratification of the treaty at the earliest. Ratification in the US, unlike in India, is in the hands of the Senate, at the Houses of Congress, and what will happen is anybody's guess. They certainly don't appear to be in a mood to do that. So, that's really unclear. So, so real lack of political will. They have a huge investment in existing infrastructure. Japan, for instance, after Fukushima said that, well, we can't trust nuclear reactors. We are going back to other fuels. So, we are no longer going to keep our earlier promised Kyoto Protocol climate targets. As it is, they were not on track to meet it. They just wrote it off. So, but on the other hand, the insistence politically from the developed countries that is that everybody must declare a long-term emission plan. Reduction plan. You are going to say how you are going to eventually reduce. We take countries like Kenya, was it Kenya or some other country whose total generation capacity just before Copenhagen was 3500 megawatt. Now, what are they doing to the world? Everybody blames Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is the bad guy. But everybody uses the oil. It is not that Saudi Arabia is per se a great emitter. It emits maximum, I think, has emitted less than 1 gigaton over the 1850 to the current period. So, so this is really, when you talk, when you hear developed countries asking for long-term emission reduction plans from developing countries, it's like, if you take a guy who is not really well fed and, who has problems with nutrition and he has some hope that eventually, that his condition will improve, he will able to have good food, etc. So, you say, before you start doing that, you must give me a diet reduction plan for the future. Because you see, look at me, I have been eating like crazy, I have put on so much weight. So, if you are going to increase your intake, maybe that is necessary for you, but give me a long-term diet reduction plan. It's as absurd as that. So, this has been the bone of contention in several, years of negotiations. So, this is the key dispute. Who is going to share the burden? What do you mean sharing the burden? So, there are two ways to think of it. Let me come back to the words later. But this is one way, one manner in which it has been thought of. And it sort of follows the letter of Article 2 of the UNFCCC, namely this idea of stabilization of trajectories. So you see here, this is that what is called the 2 degrees centigrade global stabilization trajectory. So, you know, we are currently in such bad shape with keeping temperatures under control that actually you just have to start reducing. More optimistically, 20 years ago, people thought that, you know, you could start from here, go up like this, and then maybe come down. So people spoke of a peaking year when emissions will be maximum, etc. But the basic idea that many people have thought of how to share the burden is to calculate how everybody will grow in the absence of any restriction on emissions, and then sort of add all of it together, then take how you need global emissions, and in some manner find a formula of how the gap, this reduction, should be calculated. Now, over a period of 2, 3, 4 years, 5 years, perhaps it is feasible. But when you are talking about long-term trajectories, okay, this global baseline makes no sense. Because essentially, calculating the burden for the future is like dealing with the counterfactual. What would have been if I had not reduced emissions? So that's the crux of the problem. So what determines the rate of reduction? The rate of reduction, there are some people who say everybody must start reducing. Other people give some concession to developing countries. But if you take the story as a whole, the rate of reduction is pretty arbitrary. You know, but it's fixed partly by climate change and partly by simply how much shock to the GDP you can take. So Stern recommended from the UK report something like a maximum of 6% of GDP per year worth of reduction, and so on and so forth. So this is one view and very problematic. So the crux of the problem, however, here is, see, if you estimate how your baseline will grow, what you will do without emissions, what can you reasonably do? You can only extrapolate from the present. So basically, all our future, and this is future up to 2050, 2100, etc., all our energy requirements are going to be based on extrapolation from the present. Unfortunately, I didn't bring curves of, you know, showing India's emissions. You know, it's like China will go up there. Let me go back to the graph. So, you know, of this, something like 20% is China. Then there, you know, EU is some big percentage. India is some little band, you know. So, basically, they are saying that, you know, project for the future. So, when you extrapolate the Indian trajectory for the future and estimate what India should do, you make assumptions about what your economic structure in terms of physical production and production facilities and energy use will be in the future. So why do you want to sign an agreement in 2015 for my energy future in 2100? It's hardly, you know, it's not something which sounds equitable. So this, in some sense, is the crux of the problem. A large number of well-meaning people out there in the international NGOs who think this is not a problem, but I spent some time really talking to them. It's an uphill task. The other point which the flow approach misses completely is that development is a cumulative effect. If the mainstream economics cannot get hold of it, that's not our problem. You know, but economics works on this, you know, the GDP as a measure. It's not a stupid thing. It has, it's important and valuable in many ways. But when you talk of GDP as a measure, you know, it is about growing from the previous year to the value added in the year that has passed. So when does GDP grow very rapidly? After a war. No, after the Second World War, there was a boom in reconstruction. America's rise to superpowerdom was powered partly by that. All the economies did very well. There was full employment. All kinds of things happened. So do you recommend war as a measure of boosting growth? Hardly, no. So the problem is there is a point, there is a problem in the way you think about it in economics of stocks versus flows. And development as a cumulative effort. Of course, stocks versus flows, you have to worry about what will happen to your existing infrastructure, for instance, 100 years from now. The United States has a serious problem with a real creaking infrastructure in many respects. But the point really is that development in many ways is a cumulative effect and not a flow effect. So you may reach the target. Suppose you want to, you know, housing for all. Whether we will reach it by the centenary of our independence, how many people are willing to bet that we will reach housing for all by 2047? Not, you know. So we have tasks like this ahead of us. So this is a cumulative effect, is not a flow effect. So if we want a target for how much infrastructure we will create, after 2100 we are all in deep water. So we are assuming that all energy can be taken care of by renewables or non-fossil fuels of some kind by 2100. But till 2100 itself, if we want to have full infrastructure built out in this country, that is a cumulative thing. It is not a flow issue. So given that, what was very interesting that my colleagues and I came to this idea of talking about countries' need for emissions, not in terms of flow, not in terms of how much you emit per annum, but how much you can emit overall over a certain period. Okay? So this was the idea that we had, and we called it a carbon budget. Variations of this idea have floated around in the literature for a long time. And the first place where, based on the work of my colleagues, where I wrote this up was actually in the pages of the Hindu before the Copenhagen conference. It was a simple little piece I wrote just explaining the idea. So our idea was this. So this is what the world should do in terms of emissions. Okay? This is a flow, but the point is it actually says totally how much emissions are allowed till say 2050, as is given here. If you simply take the area under the curve, so our idea was you take whatever stabilization trajectory that you wish, you take the total area under the curve, which gives you the cumulative emissions, and it is this cumulative emissions which should be shared. And not based on flows, how much you will reduce every year, will I rise and reduce, all of that is unnecessary. If I only have a cumulative target, I can take various curves whose area under the curve are similar. So I can take a very long, sort of very shallow curve, you know, very almost flat, rising gradually for a long period and tapering off slowly. Most likely we will do that in any case. Whereas China would show a trajectory which is very sharply rising, and given then they can as equally sharply reduce. For instance, in order to meet some energy targets some 4 years ago, I think, China decided to retire old power plants, and they retired more capacity than we built in the 11th plan. Okay? So, but different countries, you know, there are wide variety of countries, very different trajectories. So basically, this was the idea that we started with in terms of dealing with cumulative emissions, saying that the world has a budget in terms of emissions, total emission. It is this budget that should be shared. Now, we wrote this up, actually. And then found that the independently in the scientific literature, driven primarily by concerns there is a sensitive parameter. People call, there is a parameter called climate sensitivity, okay? For a given amount of flux of energy, okay, as a consequence of greenhouse gas emissions, what will be the temperature rise. So, there is a constant of proportionality, and this they tried to bound across different classes of models, variation in parameters, and it was not behaving too well. So, the uncertainty in that ratio, which is pretty crucial, was difficult. So, then people started thinking of it in terms of not looking at equilibrium temperature increase after emission stop and the emissions sort of and the atmosphere stabilizes, theoretically speaking, not in practical term. So, instead of looking at that parameter, they thought a better parameter is actually probably more useful in the short term. Capture short term emissions is what is called transient climate response. So, if you steadily pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, let us say a 1% increase per annum, and then roughly over say 70 years the concentration doubles in the atmosphere, and then what is the temperature response. So, it is much better for short term, and it certainly started looking at as if this was even more useful policy wise.
What do you mean by short term? How short is short?
See, short term in the sense that if you are talking of this equilibrium climate sensitivity, ECS parameter as they call it, in modeling experiments you have to really run it over very long periods of time, etcetera. So, whereas in the case of this it your modeling runs over shorter periods, okay?
70 to 100 years.
So, that is why cumulative emission targets are people do 2050 or 2100. Now, that is still in terms of how much carbon dioxide you pump and what is the transient response. It is a different matter. So, in some sense policy wise it is useful. What is the maximum temperature you will reach, okay? And to keep the maximum possible, because in different scenarios temperature can reach a peak and then decline a little and stabilize. So, you are not quite so interested in that. It is the peak which is really the issue, in terms of policy, in terms of the safety of populations, etcetera. So,
this suggestion about the area under the curve, it has, of course, it's very pragmatic and so on, but it has the following potential danger, right? I mean, every current government might say that, well, we will rise a little bit, okay, and until so during my 5-year tenure, okay, I'll just take care of the rise, and the next government should take care of the fall.
Yeah, that I agree, but I think the context in which we are talking about was a global agreement where you would make commitments. So, our position on this, in contrast to many of our friends, Baji is witness to some of those discussions, contrast to many of our friends in the climate change sort of danda in the country, various people in various organizations, government, etcetera, said that we will make no promises whatsoever, okay. So, we have problems of development, so our future in terms of emissions is open ended, we will not commit anything. Whereas, our argument when we started this line of work in 2009, and it became quite controversial with officials and other friends, etcetera. We said India should make a commitment, but the commitment should be that you take what cumulative emissions are allowed and you divide it in a fair and equitable manner. Then everybody is bound to it. So, our responsibility, so to speak, is quantified. And it is quantified in an equitable way, but it is also transparent and clear. So, you think of the world having a carbon budget, this is the total you can use, and you have a share, You may trade, you may exchange, you may do other things afterwards. But this is the foundation. So we found actually that the scientific literature provided extraordinary support to this way of thinking about it. But what really nailed it was the fact that through modeling, okay, model runs, etc., people found that there is a approximately linear relationship between cumulative emissions and maximum transient temperature response. Okay? So here is cumulative emissions. Now, cumulative emissions does not mean, you know, I have an emissions trajectory. That's why the area under the curve idea is a bit problematic. That I go up and I do arbitrarily put a cutoff, and this cumulative emissions, it means that's all the emissions that take place. So which means it must start wherever it starts, eventually end at zero, and that area is what is relevant. But if you take cumulative emissions and you look at the temperature rise which will occur, it is approximately linear. So this these are observations. The red is the orange and blue, there are slight variations. These are modeling, you know, scenario details. But the burden of the story is that there is a distribution. It's not as if there is an uncertainty in the range of temperature increase. But there is, if you take the mean, you can sensibly talk of a linear relationship between cumulative emissions and temperature rise. Now, there is actually two effects, okay, which are both nonlinear, cancelling each other to produce a linear effect. Okay, so when we found that paper, we were quite kicked. So when you talk of a global carbon budget, and this is what we learned from the scientific literature, is that you must talk of it in probabilistic terms. So if you want a certain probability, where does the probability come from? It comes from the fact that there are modeling uncertainties and, you know, stuff like that. The feedbacks are uncertain, physical feedbacks, climate feedbacks, and these are recovered through, you know, people do model simulations. There is also, they take into account a range of models who do comparable runs. And so overall, you have an idea of the probability distribution. So you have the budget. Now, the point about this, as I said, is there is no economic calculation involved. You find the equitable modality for sharing the budget, you are done. Afterwards, living under it, it's a problem shared by the world as a whole. So, if you have to be really sure, okay, that you won't cross 2 degrees centigrade, so less than 33% probability of exceeding 2 degrees centigrade. This is 992 gigatons of carbon, not carbon dioxide, and between 1870 and 2100. This is what you could emit. Now, if 50% is kind of the borderline, so you know, so the budget will go up, not tremendously, but it goes up by 10-12%, and given the unknowns in the future, you don't know whether it is, you know, you wouldn't drop, you would keep that thing in account. So this is, so there is a range for the global carbon budget. Yeah, that's what we in this case, meaning the world as a whole, because that's the problem here. So what is emitted? 667 is already emitted. So this figure is with carbon dioxide and non-CO2, etc., taken into account. How is this to be divided? So 67 is already emitted, and so we are left with 325 to 545 depending on how much the probability of exceeding 2 degrees. And so, how are you going to share this? So, this is a much better story. So, you talk of you think of it as a global commons. It's not that carbon dioxide is pure pollution, and there is some terrible writing you can see around, you know, this very famous person Naomi Klein, you know. So, she has this thing about fossil fuel, capitalism, etcetera, etcetera. It's absurd stuff. So, then there is all kinds of literature which you will get on how steam engine are inherently capitalist inventions, etcetera, or the amount of muck out there, you know. But this, you know, treats makes it clear, you know. So, you if you treat it as a global commons, you know, a common resource that should be shared, instead of simply thinking of it as pollution, okay, then I think there is room to argue about the case for developing countries, etcetera. The West quite insists on the pollution approach, even though they are the greatest polluters. Okay, they insist on the pollution approach because you cannot quite say I have a claim to more emissions. So, they say really you think you are going to pollute more, you know. So, it really tilts the way you talk about it. So, thinking of it as a budget, you see, if there are papers, several groups have studied the old stabilization scenario idea versus cumulative emissions idea, and if you look at this graph, you will see actually that you can't see it here, but these are the they are marked various stabilization scenarios in terms of the concentration of CO2 in the future, which were calculated earlier, and they have compared it to the cumulative emissions story. So, scientifically, it's not as if we are saying something different, but we, you know, we are presenting it. Of course, there are two slightly different modes of calculation, two parameters you are talking about. But really, the real crux of the problem is that we have a way scientifically sound about thinking about it, which provides transparently a more equitable way of dealing with the burden sharing in reducing emissions. It's a bit like that story of, you know, after all the developments in the understanding of the solar system, you know, the earth was no longer at the center, the sun was at the center. But then we discovered that you can change frames of reference, no? So, you could calculate all the motions of the bodies with, you know, earth as the center. It's simply that you have to do the right change of frame of reference. So, the end of it, what is it that you got? You know, through this complicated route, you came back perhaps to being comfortable with the earth as frame of reference, but you are no longer the frame of center of creation. And this was actually a amusing conversation I once had with Rajaji. And we were discussing this. So, you know, and this is really the thinking of the universe as anthropocentric was, you know, totally dethroned, you know. So, it's a bit like that, you know. So, you come around and you do carbon budget. It's not as if carbon budgets are necessarily totally different from the way the old stabilization scenario was in scientific terms. But what it does is, it gives you a new perspective on how to solve the problem as a social, economic, and essentially human problem. It's not about the atmosphere, it is about us. So, all environmental problems are anthropocentric. There is no runaway greenhouse effect is there on Venus. It's not an environmental question. That's just, planetary atmospheres. On the earth, it is an environmental question. Anyway, so what has the West been doing? What have the developed countries been doing? They have been basically gobbling up the carbon space, to cut a long story short. So I am, you know, I will run out of time. A few more things I want to say. So I won't parade you through the numbers, but basically, how do you calculate what is everybody's fair share? So, you know, the people think that in India, we use the per capita argument because we are using population as a weapon. This is really Malthusian, you know, paranoia. It's all over the place. So, you know, I tell my students of, you know, course I teach on the environment, I tell them when I talk about economics and the environment, I said, forget about Adam Smith, Ricardo, Marx, all these guys. Nobody hears of them. But in every conversation on environment, the ghost of Malthus is standing in the room, in the corner. So, you know, there is this Malthusian obsession about population. But in India, I don't think there is no reasonable evidence to suggest we are using population as a weapon in negotiation. And there is really no reason why the per capita principle should not work. We can modify it, you can do what you want with it, weight it by different indicators. Whatever it is, you cannot hide the fact that the yeah.
What is HDI?
Human Development Index. So you weight it, you know, some way or the other. So this is just, there is no slack. I have just taken the total amount and simply divided it across from 1870 to 2100. So what has the developed countries won? Annex 1 refers to the annex in the UNFCCC, it refers to developed countries. So, this is their, what have they emitted so far? 492. So, they have just simply gobbled it up. See, they have a problem, and it is really from the developing countries also in the rhetoric, you know. Unscientifically, we have been talking about their responsibility while sort of conflating it with culpability. I think it would have been useful if the rhetoric had been toned down at an earlier stage, but we were simply punched drunk on it. India and a whole bunch of developing countries. It's a bit odd because everything else we are doing domestically flies in the face of the so-called per capita principle, you know. Why don't we have, say, housing per capita, floor space per capita? Why don't you have food availability per capita and guarantee everybody gets that food? It's not as if the rest of the world doesn't see this. But, you know, but the per capita rhetoric and talking about this overdrawal of earlier emissions in terms of using the word responsibility, is called historical responsibility, the term is obvious, but conflating it, confusing it with culpability was always the problem, and we never successfully decoupled that, because in some sense it is true that technology is uncertain. See, if you had not discovered petroleum, even the few whales which are left for sightseeing would not have been left. No? There is the great jump in agricultural productivity would not have been possible without petroleum based fertilizers. Maybe you could have used coal, this, that, etc. The cities of Europe cleaned up in appearance because they shifted from coal to gas. The Eastern Europe, Soviet Union didn't. So, you know, they used to use coal, they used to look dingy, while the rest of the place got cleaned up. So, energy transitions are not simply things you can guarantee. There is a lot of uncertainty. So, anyway, whatever it is, they are responsible. So, if there is a common resource, you have to share it. And this occupation cannot be undone. There is no way you can get the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. So they said in Norway or somewhere they have frozen it, Norway or Ireland. There is algae which is going to consume it. All very well. I think these are good subjects of serious research. But is that a solution on the cards? Answer is no. And it may take the same time scale as 2050 or 2075 for this to be available. So you have to do something. Now, an amazing fact, before I move on, is the resistance we have faced that even other scientists. So if you look at the fifth assessment report, it is entirely dominated, not in the written version, but if you look at all the presentations that IPCC's working group 1 has made to the UNFCC, they have made in press releases, one of the things they speak of up front is the carbon budget approach. Cumulative emissions and the way to share it. They have written Nature papers on it. So it is really there. But what is interesting, and that really shows up something, is a kind of political resistance to it. So Cristiana Figueres, who is Secretary General of the UNFCCC, is quoted in that Nature paper on cumulative emissions as telling the scientists who wrote it, as say, you know, this is not feasible, won't fly. She's a Secretary General of the UNFCCC. Why should she take a position on a particular methodology of calculating emission burden sharing? But she ruled it out of court. In 2010, we held a conference on this in TIS. We had Jairam Ramesh come over, and Jairam Ramesh had, he was very thrilled with all the stuff we showed him. He has some engineering background, IITB graduate, so he was very kicked with it. So he drafted a statement, a press statement, where he said that the one of the possible things we should aim for to solve climate is the equalization of per capita cumulative emissions. This is basically the budget idea. He flew off from here, from Mumbai, to Rome for the MEF, Major Energy, what's it called? Some Energy Forum. It's a G7 offshoot where the rich guys with the not so rich guys sit and talk about energy and how to fix the world. He went off to the MEF, and later, it transpired, and it is pretty clear it must have been the Americans. They told him, budgets, just forget it. Just forget it. And that was it. There was no statement ever after from the Minister for the Environment on carbon budgets, but it was picked up only recently in the run-up to Paris. So, there is a huge pushback on this in political terms, but the beauty of the story is that even if you consider, so if you don't have this, even in terms of flows, what these countries have promised at Paris is highly inadequate. So the solid lines, the blue is USA, the red is EU, the solid lines are what they have promised in Paris. They are called INDCs, etc. The dotted lines were what they should have been doing, and this was already reported in AR4, the fourth assessment report in 2007. So even in flow terms, they are not doing much. But this is the worst part of it all. So what is the crux of the Paris Agreement? So there are other slides, etc. I will wind up with this point, and we can either talk about it or you can look it up on the web page or whatever. The crux of the point is, in Paris, what was the deal? Everybody agreed that there would be a deal. So everybody wanted a deal. So you must have a deal. But what kind of deal? A deal that everybody could agree on. So the chain, strength of the chain is determined by the weakest link. So what it is that the United States could agree on? What can the United States agree on? It cannot agree on anything which involves something substantive, because that is the prerogative of the Senate. They will get involved and that there will be trouble. Okay? So all the things that they can agree on are procedural. So it's full of procedure, of things to do, of, and of course, you know, the obsession of the West today, monitoring and evaluation. Even before you do anything, you know, the monitoring evaluation boys will arrive before they have given you a dollar of their money. So monitoring and evaluation, review mechanism, this, that and the other. So then, you know, more promises of money. They have promised it in Copenhagen and it is a terrible story. There is no money, real money turning up to help poorer countries. What is the other thing they had to do? They had to promise the island states something. So here everybody comes to this conference saying what they will do to reduce, keep temperatures below 2 degrees centigrade. That's all they have promised. Everything is predicated on that. And as I showed you in the earlier graph, even that is inadequate. But they come to this meeting and they say, oh, well, everybody wants 1.5, we will go for 1.5. So let me tell you the story. So the UNFCCC has done these calculations. So for staying below, 2 degrees centigrade with 66% probability, if you are talking only of carbon dioxide, you have 1000 gigatons left. Given all the promises in Paris, how much will we consume by 2025? 542. How much will we consume by 2030? 748. So 75% of that budget is gone within the next 15 years. Okay? If you have 50% probability, so you know, it is slightly weaker, then 1300 is the budget. But by 2030, you have already blown more than half. So now, you can guess what will happen with 1.5. The UNFCCC didn't calculate 1.5. This was done by the UNFCCC secretariat before Paris. So before Paris was only 2. They can't do 1.5. That will create a ruckus. Okay? But the, after Paris, then I can do the calculation myself. Is all the numbers are there in the IPCC. You spend half a day, you can do it for yourself. It is totally elementary. So 50% probability of staying below 1.5 is 550 gigatons of CO2, not carbon. So you want to convert to carbon, it is into 12 over 44. Okay? So 33% probability of staying below 1.5, 850 until 2100. So what did they promise? 1.5. Now, I cursed it. No, I really cursed it in the media. Here and there a few people read it. So like this guy from, Kings, or he's one of these major UK centers, or Tyndall, I think. I'm not sure. He's one of the major guys in climate modeling in the UK. He's a big figure. So Kevin Anderson said 1.5 degrees centigrade is in the rear view mirror. No, and even more ridiculously, the IPCC has extensive discussion in the fifth assessment report of how, what are the impacts of emissions on various aspects of the world if temperature rises 2 degrees centigrade. So everybody said, but we don't know 1.5. So IPCC has been given a specific task of calculating impacts of climate change for a 1.5 degree rise in temperature. And none of the IPCC guys even stood up and said, what will happen at 1.5? Less than 2. Climate change better be, impacts better be monotonically increasing with temperature. Otherwise, 4 degrees centigrade would be a good thing to have. And nobody possibly thinks that is absurd. But the question is, what is happening here? And that's really the question to understand. There is no question that the one of the, there are two things which are at play. Major players in the West, it includes corporates. Bill Gates is very clear. Bill Gates said renewable energy, etc., we have to invest more, all this burden sharing, etc., all this is not going to work. So, Bill Gates opted for, and he gave an interview before Paris, he said put lots of money after perhaps his leftover from traveling to Mars or you know all these things these guys are interested in, and we will invest in technology. So, technology is the solution. And this was echoed by The Economist in an editorial, lots of people. And then there was this club that Bill Gates formed, Jeff Bezos was part of it, Ambani saab ko bhi bulaya gaya, you know, Mukesh Ambani is part of it. So, this is one part of the story. The other part of the story is that the screws will turn on us. So, they have existing infrastructure. China played its cards brilliantly. China was working on the idea of carbon budgets, and they had 2-3 tracks in parallel. I know the Chinese carbon budget guys because we used to collaborate. We had a joint committee with Brazilians, Chinese and the South Africans, and we wrote a note on this which is available on our website. All this, so they are completely on board. But they had different investments. They had somebody investigating other means, all of that. When they realized that they have reached a point where going green, going renewable is helpful to them in economic terms. And in any way, you know, they have used a pretty good share of their carbon budget. So, they decided peaking year doesn't hurt us. Peaking year helps them because they have only said when they will peak. They have not said where they will peak. So, how much the area under the curve is, they have not specified. So, they actually played the West's game back to them. So, they gave a peaking year and they said by 2035, if possible, we'll do it a bit earlier, we will peak. When they will peak and what is the rate of decline also, they didn't specify. So they won that round, and after the Obama-China Jinping deal, Hollande went to Beijing in October. There was a detailed discussion. In my review of agrarian studies paper, I have spoken about this, or in the EPW paper, Hollande and Jinping issued a statement. And all the points that appear in the Paris Agreement are more or less covered, which would make developing countries politically unhappy. But the point is us. Even the ministry accepts it. Senior official, after Paris we were talking, he said, "Ab chhodiye, wo China to aage nikal gaya. Aba hamare bare mein boliye." So, you know, so what is our problem? We have made promises on deploying renewables which are incredible. How we are going to meet them, we have to think about it. It's not obvious that it will work. Various things about the international trade economic environment may change. So, we have to see how that will play out. But most seriously, if there are people who have actually occupied carbon space which cannot be undone, the science will speak for itself. And in 4, 5, 6, 8, 10 years, as you go down the road, the fact that there is no carbon budget left will be amply clear. Then there will be emergency, there will be calls to take urgent action. Who is left to take urgent action? The one who has not reached the table. So, the problems that we are likely to face are significant. Now, to the credit of the government, okay, for the first time they kept up this talk of the carbon budget for the first week of the conference. It was even there in the text. It went through an iteration. So, you know, after the first week, all kinds of hera-feri starts happening, you know. So, the secretariat starts rewriting the text and saying, okay, will this do? You know, it's not negotiated. Somebody gives a take it or leave it kind of text. So, people argue over it. So, we got a text where any reference to the carbon budget disappeared. So, that was the point, make or break. But by then, Obama had called all the BRICS leaders, not BRICS, but you know, the basic leaders. John Kerry had had dinner with Javadekar. So, that was it. So I think the problem is serious in two respects. I think partly the island nations have been fooled thoroughly. So, I have this image in my mind of somebody drawing me a nice cartoon. So, you have a typical picture of a South Sea island, no? Southern Pacific island, coconut palms, etc. And Samoan or Fijian looking figure standing in water up to his knees. And the coconut palms half in water, and he shakes his fist at a aeroplane aircraft going above, and he said, but you promised me 1.5 degrees. Okay? This is the state we are on. So, it is not at all clear how this 1.5 is going to be met. There is very little scope for this. It is not at all clear what we are going to do with the consequences when they are not met. Because the idea is now it will be met. And we are fooling ourselves even in India, but I don't think the Indian government will take that position. We are looking at 2. Nobody thinks in India we are looking at 1.5. But if other countries think they are looking at 1.5, you will under prepare for adaptation, no? Whereas 2 will have more serious consequences. So, this I think globally also is extremely problematic. For India in particular, among the developing countries, it has left us with a complex and difficult problem. So, even in terms of a fair share of what remains of carbon space, forget the past, even in those terms, the developed nations are taking much more than their share. So that's the issue with Paris, and I think this is the crux of the problem that emerged at Paris, and not, you know, it was a political success, maybe, but it will get undone. It will get very much undone, and personally, I think in short order, but we'll all be around to see. So, we'll know in a few years whether these criticisms are correct. Thank you. I'll stop there, and sorry for running over my time. I completely agree with you, but it is not in fashion. Not in fashion. That's unfortunately the problem. The environmental problem, whether it is global, local, regional, at whatever scale, is collective action. And it involves somewhere at some level, despite all the game theory that you do with it, it involves putting moral concerns above simply direct personal interests. And we live in a system increasingly praised and trumpeted praised and extolled to the skies, where you say that's foolish. We'll wait and see. So, but in the meantime, there is a task at least of telling people what exactly is going on. But in that, I agree entirely with the spirit of your comment.
Photograph which is taken by one of the TFR family members.
Okay, thank you.